Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we want to hear from you about the smells of your childhood, what they were, and what they remind you of. First, the city of Milwaukee has reached a tentative deal with the ACLU of Wisconsin over a lawsuit that accuses police of unfairly targeting minorities via stop and frisk. According to the suit, police were frequently stopping minorities without cause or suspicion. Some researchers found disparities to be more than 6 times higher for African Americans than for whites. After the suit was filed early last year, the lead plaintiff in the case, Charles Collins, a black man who said he was pulled over in 2014 without explanation, said stop and frisk has made him nervous.
I've gotten to a point where I'm always looking over my shoulders, you know. There's an anxiety in me.
Cornell Law School refers to stop and frisk as a brief, non-intrusive police stop of a suspect, but they must have a reasonable suspicion that a crime either has been, is being, or is about to be committed by the suspect. If so, police can give a quick pat-down of the subject's outer clothing. Former Milwaukee Police Chief Ed Flynn denied his department even used stop and frisk.
I'm going to take this opportunity to categorically and unequivocally reject the base of the assertions made by the ACLU.
The settlement is worth $1.9 million. It also orders the Milwaukee Police Department and the Fire and Police Commission to change its use of stop and frisk and improve data collection. Here to explain what that all means is Ashley Luthern, the public safety reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She covered yesterday's settlement agreement between the city and the ACLU. Ashley, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
This lawsuit dates back to February of last year. What exactly did the ACLU accuse the Milwaukee Police Department of doing?
Well, it was a class action civil rights lawsuit alleging that the Milwaukee Police Department engaged in stop and frisk practices that specifically targeted African American and Latino pedestrians and drivers in the city.
And what did they base that on? What kind of data did they have to back up their argument?
So they based that on traffic stop data, pedestrian stop data, as well as what percentage were searched after those stops or frisked in the common, you know, it's often referred to as stop and frisk as well. And so they were arguing that officers were routinely doing these, what they believe to be illegal stops in neighborhoods that were disproportionately affecting African American and Latino residents. And kind of because of that, they brought forward this lawsuit and they gathered more data as part of it, got experts to weigh in, and that kind of led to where we are now with this tentative settlement.
So these allegations occurred while Ed Flynn was running the police department in Milwaukee. He has since retired, and the city filed a motion to try to dismiss the suit, given that he's no longer there. They referred to him, I believe, as the chief architect of these policies. What was Flynn's response to the accusations when he was in office?
So when Chief Flynn was here, he vigorously defended the department. He denied that the department practiced stop and frisk, and he defended these high-volume traffic stops as an effective way of reducing non-fatal shootings, robberies, and car thefts. You know, he's saying you're seeing these disproportionate numbers because we're going where crime is occurring. You know, the community demands that we address crime, so we are going to those areas. He had a very similar response back, I believe, in I forget the exact year, forgive me, but the Journal Sentinel, before I started working here, did its own analysis of traffic stops and found that they were disproportionately affecting minority residents in the city.
And how disproportionate are we finding these stops are? I mean, is it, you know, it's 10% more than it would be if it was just by population, or, you know, 100% or 200% more? What's the gravity of the situation?
So a Journal Sentinel analysis, which is cited in the ACLU lawsuit that was back in 2011, it found that Milwaukee's disparities were larger than other big city areas. So it was 3.9 for African Americans and 2.1 for Latinos, and that means that they were almost, you know, African American drivers or pedestrians were almost 4 times as likely to be stopped as white residents in the city.
So, as we said, Ashley, yesterday a city committee approved a $1.9 million settlement that still needs approval from the full city council and Mayor Tom Barrett. What does that settlement entail?
The settlement entails a monetary amount, $1.9 million, that goes towards the court costs and plaintiff's attorney's fees, the cost of expert witnesses and depositions that have already occurred as part of this lawsuit. But the settlement also includes a five-year consent decree that requires the Milwaukee Police Department and the city's Fire and Police Commission, which is the civilian oversight board, to reform the stop and search practices and, you know, improve their training, improve their data collection on this issue, and, you know, undergo new policies. And there's going to be a consultant who's already been hired, at least is a consultant has been proposed as part of this settlement, who will monitor this and issue regular reports that says how the department is doing towards reducing these disparities. You know, the city's aldermen, or at least one of them, was quick to point out that there was no finding of wrongdoing or admitting of wrongdoing as part of this settlement agreement that's been proposed, but that there wasn't a 100% clean bill of health either. That was how Alderman Bob Bauman put it in an interview yesterday.
And just to be clear, Ashley, it sounds like none of this settlement will go directly to people who were affected by the stop and frisk policies, who were stopped themselves. There were a couple cases that you talked about in your article where, you know, people were pretty deeply affected by being stopped, but no money is going directly to them.
Correct. I mean, the lawsuit itself did not seek damages. I mean, I think the real goal here was to change how the Milwaukee Police Department does business in the city.
We're talking with Ashley Lutheran right now. She's the public safety reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're talking with her about the settlement reached, tentative settlement for now, between the city of Milwaukee and the ACLU over the Milwaukee Police Department's use of stop and frisk. So the committee approved the settlement. What was the general attitude of the committee members towards taking the step?
So I will be honest, I had to follow up this story late yesterday evening, so I was not present for the committee, but I spoke to the chairman, Alderman Mark Borkowski, late last night, and he said, you know, there's a lot of frustration from council members because they continue to, you know, have these proposed settlements go before them related to police misconduct, but that ultimately they felt like it was important for the city to move forward, that there were important reforms attached to this, and that, you know, both he and Alderman Bauman said that they were assured that that $1.9 million, you know, is an accurate representation of the costs that are owed. And so, as Alderman Borkowski said, you know, it's up to the city now to make things right and go forward, and hopefully we'll never have a situation like this again, is what he told me last night.
And it sounds, too, like if that consultant that's being brought in to kind of monitor what progress is being made, if that consultant's fees starts getting to be higher than was expected, then the city can actually kind of go back and ask for some relief for that.
Indeed. Alderman Bauman pointed out that this five-year consent agreement will remain under the jurisdiction of the federal court, so that if the city does have some concerns or they feel like there are some exorbitant fees, because the dollar amount right now is unknown, the city will have to pay for that consultant. They can go back to federal court and ask for a consideration of that and try to get the cost reduced.
As we mentioned, the city council and Mayor Barrett are needed to sign off on the settlement to make it put it into place. What's your sense of the likelihood that that will go through without any problems?
I think it will go through without any problems. Some of the most outspoken opponents of these settlements in the past include people like Alderman Borkowski, and he, as well as the other members of his committee, they passed it on a 5-0 vote, so it was unanimous. I think that signals that they realize this is as good of a resolution, I think, as they could have hoped for in the sense of a wide-ranging class action civil rights lawsuit.
Last fall, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported that police misconduct had cost city taxpayers at least $17 million in legal settlements since 2015, actually $21 million if you factor in interest along with fees to outside attorneys. That seems like that must have had a pretty big impact on the department's budget.
So it's not coming out of the police department's budget. That's another point that has been debated and discussed at the common council level. Often the city sets aside only $1.5 million to settle all lawsuits, so whether it's police-related or whether it's related to the Department of Public Works, maybe like a snow truck hits someone's, you know, property and they have to settle a lawsuit there. And because of that, they've relied on borrowing. And it appears that that's exactly what they're going to do in this case as well.
So obviously this stop and frisk lawsuit that the ACLU filed on behalf of Black and Latino residents in Milwaukee is one aspect, but it sounds like there have been many other police misconduct issues. Are there any that are currently still working their way through the courts or might be on the horizon?
Probably the largest one that's still on the horizon is the lawsuit involving the death of Derek Williams. Mr. Williams was taken into custody, I believe it was back in 2011, and the Journal Sentinel did a lot of reporting on this. He died in the back of a squad car. He was gasping for air. None of the officers were ever criminally charged at the state or federal level, nor were they found to have done any wrongdoing at the department level. However, that civil lawsuit is proceeding through, and if that comes to a settlement or a jury trial, there's a possibility of another large payout, possibly, and that would probably be the most high-profile case that's still on the horizon. And you kind of see this coming up as, for example, in the case of Dontre Hamilton's estate, it was $2.3 million. Mm-hmm. That was the settlement. So those are kind of the monetary figures that we're seeing in recent months.
And Ashley, as we wrap up, as we noted, none of this $1.9 million settlement is going directly to people who may have been subject to stop and frisk that as the result of racial profiling. So they're not making any money off of this. But do you have a sense what it could mean for people in these communities to see this kind of settlement be reached on their behalf?
I think with any of these kinds of actions, whether we're talking about a settlement that involves a consent decree, which, again, is something that I have not seen in my 5 years here covering the Milwaukee Police Department, and other things like the federal draft report that was, halted midway, that was reviewing all aspects of the Milwaukee Police Department, I think what you really get from, what you really hear from residents in a lot of these communities is a sense of validation. Like, we've been sharing these stories and sharing these concerns for decades at this point. And so, of course, there's frustration that it takes so long for these things to be resolved or to be publicly acknowledged in this way, whether it's through a settlement, whether it's through an outside report. But I think there's some amount of feeling, vindicated by these kinds of things, And I think that moving forward, the hope is that this and other community efforts, there's so much being led by the residents of Milwaukee in terms of reforming the police department and helping decide what kind of police department they want in their neighborhoods, that I think it's a really interesting time for the city and the police department itself as they move forward.
Well, Ashley, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Ashley Lutheran is the public safety reporter at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked with her about the settlement reached between the city of Milwaukee and the ACLU over the police department's use of stop and frisk. Right now, the New York Times recently published an essay by a Serbian author in which she reminisced about the smells of her childhood in Belgrade. The Times editors then compiled some of the responses they received after that original essay was published. One was from Marge in Wisconsin. She shared, "As goofy as it sounds, the smell of gasoline immediately transports me back to the farm in Wisconsin where I grew up. My dad used to fill the tractor with gasoline, and on occasion he would let me sit on his lap while he drove it, plowing the fields in spring. I loved riding on that tractor, smelling the fresh, moist ground being plowed up while the soft, cool wind blew in my face. The smell of gasoline triggers such happy, secure, and warm memories when I was a small child. How I still miss that farm." Well, that got us thinking about the smells of our own childhoods, and we want to hear from you, too. Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tell us what the smells of your childhood were and what memories they bring up for you if you smell them now. Again, that phone number is 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Joining me in the studio is Ideas Network producer Brianne Shasso. Hi, Brianne.
Hi, Judith. Thanks for having me.
Well, I knew I had to have you join me because you emailed me right away when I said we were going to do this segment. So why not have you come and share your memories with us and tell us what the smells were of your childhood?
Well, Marge stole the show, to be completely frank, because My childhood smells are of our family farm, and when I close my eyes and I picture that, I can smell the farm, especially the barnyard right after it rained. But when I think about my dad especially, I remember the smell of baling twine, so what they would use to wrap up bales. And what it is I still do this today just because it takes me back. I would lift up the shelf portion where the twine is stored and just take the deepest breath I could. In fact, I'm a little embarrassed to admit this, but I actually took a handful of like twine shavings to college with me.
I think that's
just
great.
To do that. And so it's that smell that just takes me back to a really happy, warm, and safe time of being a kid on the farm.
That's wonderful. Well, I had a very different childhood from you. I grew up in Chicago, very urban childhood. And this is a really specific and unique one, I think. There was a Mars candy factory in our neighborhood.
Oh, wow.
So a lot of days you would walk out of the house and smell melted chocolate, like the whole neighborhood smelled like melted chocolate, which was actually, you know, quite pleasant as a kid. Other days, it smelled like French fries, but they weren't French fries. They were actually the almonds being roasted at the same candy factory. So our entire neighborhood was scented with those things.
I was going to say, I imagined as a kid, it was probably really nice to live in a place that smelled like chocolate.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I have some others to share, but let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234, and let's go to Tom in Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi, it sounds like you grew up in the Montclair neighborhood in Chicago.
Very close, yeah.
Yeah, for me, it's my father's hands. He was a printer, and the smell of printer's ink was really takes me back. But right now, I'm doing a play called Let Them Eat Cake at the Bartell in the next couple of weeks, and we've been talking about food for the last 3 weeks solid. And for me, it's mustard and oranges.
Oh, interesting. So what kind of mustard, yellow or brown?
You know, I love all mustards, but I would think just good old-fashioned French's salad mustard takes me back to childhood, for sure.
And so what would you have that mustard on as a kid, hot dogs?
Actually, I love them on mashed potatoes and potato chips.
Wow. All right.
I still do to this day.
All right. Well, thanks so much for that call, Tom. Thanks for sharing those smell memories at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Lori in Madison next. Hi, Lori.
Hi. I grew up with a Jewish grandmother, and she used to wear this pressed powder. And when she passed away, actually, I took her pressed powder. And whenever I feel like I need my grandmother's love, I just open it up and I take a whiff, and it just brings me back to when I was young, and it reminds me of her making matzo ball soup and just being loved and cuddled.
Wow. So kind of almost a comfort food smell, but not the food itself.
Correct.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that, Lori. And you know, Brianne, one of my memories also is related to a grandma. I had a Polish grandma, and she lived in this really pretty old two-story walk-up. She lived on the second floor. And the back porch area where you would go down this really kind of rickety wooden staircase out to the backyard, it just had this damp wood smell that I can, if I picture that back porch, I immediately smell it too. And it's kind of like you would imagine like at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum in New York, like this really kind of, you know, working class, really hardworking people living in these, you know, old apartments. And I can smell that to this day. And it's probably been over 30 years since I've smelled that.
You know, I too have a smell that I think of my grandmother with, and it's actually her pancakes. And she didn't measure anything. And so when she passed away, the recipe went with her. And to this day, my younger sister especially has been trying to recreate this recipe. And I can tell, we're still working on it, but I can tell just by smell alone, you know, we're not there yet.
It's not quite there. Well, thanks for that call. Let's go back to the phones, and let's go to Paul in Fond du Lac. Hi, Paul.
Hey, hello. I remember riding in my grandpa's lap on the old Case tractor, and whenever I smell either kerosene or tobacco or dairy cattle, which was usually a mixture on him, I think of him. And as to kerosene, the long trips up from Madison up to Sawyer County long ago, before the yellow flashing lights were the little round kerosene signal torches that would be around road construction at night.
Well, thank you so much for Paul. Wow, that sounds like it brings up a lot for you. And I think that's part of the thing with smells is they can evoke something so strong and so immediate. We had a lot of people comment on Facebook. One of my favorites, MC, said a fresh box of Crayolas. And as soon as I read that, I could totally smell those crayons.
I really loved that, especially because another producer from the Ideas Network, Colleen, when I told her what we were talking about today, she reminded me, you know, she's like, you know, when I think about smells, I think about like the smell of melted crayons mm-hmm. in my dad's car.
Yeah.
It's a smell that never goes away.
Right. And other kind of fun play stuff. Becky on Facebook said the smell of Play-Doh. That too, I could smell right away. Paste, which I thought was kind of funny. And powdered lemonade. And I remember pouring the powder and it kind of goes up your nose.
So
you smell it whether you want to or not. Let's take one more quick call. Jan in La Crosse. Hi, Jan.
Hi. Thanks for doing this. My smell is very unique. It's Bondo. B-O-N-D-O. Anybody that's been in an auto body shop, my dad owned one and my brother worked there, and on weekends we would go down there. And Bondo is what you put on cars that are scratched or dented to fill in the space, and then you sand it down smooth and then paint over it.
Wow, so it's kind of like spackle for cars.
Yes, it is.
Wow, and so you would spend time on the weekends in your childhood going to the auto body shop, so that's the smell.
Yes, and every time I go into any kind of a body shop and I smell that now, it just takes me right back there.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Jan. And I have, a really kind of specific one to my family, I think, or at least to Italian-American families. One of my aunts would string up Italian frying peppers they were red and then hang them over a broomstick to dry. So the smell of drying peppers, and they were delicious. Well, thank you all for sharing the smells of your childhood. You can keep that conversation going on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Brianne, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. More on Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. First, childbirth can be expensive for anyone, no matter your income. Giving birth in America is more expensive than in any other country. Hospital bills can be confusing to interpret, insurance companies can be difficult to reach, and this all happens while you're going through a major life change. This experience becomes even more overwhelming when you are uninsured and trying to find the least expensive route to having a healthy, happy baby. Molly Osberg is a staff writer at Splinter News. Her recent piece is called Pregnant, Uninsured, and Adrift. Molly, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for joining us today. Some might hear pregnant and uninsured and picture young, low-income, unemployed mothers. But you found that there's a lot more variety in that group than there is, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are more than 10 million uninsured women in America. And the women that I spoke to were uninsured for a number of reasons. You know, their employer-sponsored health care hadn't quite kicked in yet. They had issues getting on Medicaid or retroactively finding out that they weren't on Medicaid. I mean, there are a number of reasons that a woman might find herself in this position.
Before we dig in and talk more specifically about the women you spoke with, let's talk about the costs of pregnancy and delivery. How much in general does it cost to have a baby if there are no complications?
Oh, geez. I think it's something like $11,000 is the standard price, which can go all the way up to, I think, $30,000 maybe if you have a C-section with complications.
And that's not even taking into account if a child is born with, say, a chronic condition or serious health concerns that might require the baby to be, say, in the neonatal ICU or something like that. This is just basically getting the baby into the world.
Right, exactly.
So for a lot of women without insurance, that means doing the bare minimum of preventive care, doctor visits, aside from the actual birth. What are some of the corners that you found women were cutting to try to save some money?
Well, I mean, the first one is certainly just cutting down on the number of doctor visits and prenatal care that you get in the first place. I mean, one woman that I spoke to, I think that she had one ultrasound during her entire pregnancy before she went into labor.
And so what? So people are, women are just going to the doctor less, but what kind of implications can that have for pregnancy?
I mean, I think that's just a really terrifying time in the best of circumstances. A lot of the women that I spoke to were incredibly lucky to finish labor, at least with, you know, $10,000 worth of debt. You know, and you see women in, you know, even other circumstances driving, 50 miles to the lowest, the nearest low income clinic, things like that. It's just an incredible drain.
And it seems like it would be even hard to know what costs you might be incurring in that prenatal care, let alone once you're in the hospital and in labor, because I've had, you know, some recent doctor visits and some things done that I didn't know until much later when I got a bill for, you know, what wasn't covered by my insurance, what those procedures even cost. I mean, I guess I could have asked, but, you know, there's also kind of a sense of, you know, being intimidated maybe by being in the doctor's office, not being able to think of everything you wanted to bring up, things like that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the first thing that you stop doing when you realize that you can't pay for healthcare is asking those sorts of questions. I mean, you really find that women who are uninsured during their pregnancy are just not even really thinking to ask these kinds of questions.
So you talked with women, a variety of women in a variety of situations, but there really seemed to be kind of a common thread that timing is everything. So it depends when you get pregnant, when maybe your insurance kicks in. Not everyone gets insurance on day one of a job. Sometimes it's 6 months in. Can you give us maybe a story or two of the women that you talked to for whom the timing didn't work out well?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was it's so funny to watch people try to time their pregnancies along with their insurance coverage. One woman that I spoke to, actually, she had changed jobs and was covered under COBRA for, I think, 8 months after her job. And she'd actually been trying to have a child over and over and over again and kept having tragically miscarriages. And she sort of looked at the calendar and realized when her health insurance was going to run out and decided to stop trying with her husband. And then, you know, less than a month later, found out that she was pregnant. And at that point, there's really, you know, at that point in their lives, there wasn't much that they were going to do. I mean, she certainly wasn't going to terminate the pregnancy at that point. So she just sort of had to hope for the best in situations like that.
Oh, no, I was going to say, and I think you actually talked to at least one woman for whom the opposite was true, where she realized she was pregnant, did the math, and she was going to be due about a week before her insurance kicked in.
Yes, absolutely. And then it turned out that she actually delivered early, so she didn't have insurance. She was covered, I think, maybe 2 weeks after giving birth, but not for her labor, which then I think cost her $20,000, something like that.
We are talking with Molly Osberg. She's a staff writer at Splinter News. Her recent piece is called Pregnant, Uninsured, and Adrift. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Were you or someone close to you in a situation of expecting a child while uninsured? Do you have a story about the cost of pregnancy, even with insurance? Give us a call, 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're continuing the conversation with Molly Osberg, a staff writer at Splinter News. We're talking about the cost of childbirth and pregnancy when you don't have adequate insurance. And we want to hear your stories at 800-642-1234. Was paying for childbirth a struggle for you, whether you were insured or not? Did you find ways to save money through the pregnancy that you'd like to share? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Molly, you know, I think insurance can be tricky to navigate for anyone, but when you're pregnant, does that make it even more complicated?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's one of the things I've in this particular situation, what I found so interesting after doing a lot of other reporting on healthcare insurance for people who had sort of like traumatic issues, is that you would think that being pregnant would be this incredibly natural process. And I think that no one really thinks as their first question when they get pregnant about their healthcare bills and insurance costs, right? You're already concerned with so many things, the health of the baby.
Right. And what kind of insurance options might be available to women who maybe didn't have insurance themselves, but now that they're pregnant, does that open any doors for them or does it close more doors than open them?
Well, I mean, you could say one of the comments that I get a lot when I do these sorts of stories is that there are a lot of, you know, places, say, Planned Parenthood, low-income birth centers, things like that, where you can actually get care. But, you know, in terms of even the state-sponsored marketplaces, the Affordable Care Act, they've modeled themselves on the private insurance companies. So you actually, you can't get prenatal care through like an Obamacare program. It really doesn't kick in until the moment that you give birth.
So some women that you spoke with were weighing the choice between paying high monthly insurance premiums versus paying for the pregnancy costs, pregnancy and delivery costs out of pocket. I think one said she felt like she was paying in installments in advance mm-hmm. by paying those premiums. They were each looking at their own personal individual circumstances. You were looking more at the big picture. Did you find that one of those options seem to have better results for people?
Oh, you know, I wish that I could tell you that one was better than the other. But I mean, so much of this is so dependent on state by state policies, where you happen to be, if you're in a rural area, how far you have to travel to get any of this care. Yeah, I mean, I think that the real balancing act for a lot of these women was trying to negotiate all this themselves, sometimes without adequate information. One of the things that I found really surprising was the number of women who are, say, eligible for Medicaid even, who don't realize it and never even think to try to go for these programs.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Linda in Minneapolis is up. Hi, Linda.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to share?
I guess what I would like to share is that, you know, I'm in my late 50s, 59, and my first child I did not have any health insurance, and it put me well over, you know, $5,000 in debt, and it ended up having to file bankruptcy. And just looking at the situation, and I was in the 80s, and I'm just sad to see that it's still going on, and that you know, I just feel like women need to just there need to be better resources and better information and more availability of that information for them, so that they don't end up in a situation like I did.
And so what was the long-term effect on you and your family of having a baby when it was really not that affordable for you?
Long-term effect, you know, you just made do. You cut corners. I filed bankruptcy. I then went to the county realizing that, oh, there is a program for me that, you know, I can get medical health care for, you know, my then daughter at the time and myself if I decided to have another pregnancy.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Linda. I appreciate you calling with your story. And Molly, one of the things that you pointed out is that some of the women you talked with were actually working with the hospitals in very close contact with them to pay off their bills. And then all of a sudden, they get a notice from a collection agency that they're being taken to court when they thought that they, you know, kind of had an agreement going.
Yeah. I mean, I think that she's absolutely right that the lack of information is a huge barrier for these sorts of things. It's an incredibly difficult system to navigate, so much so that, you know, you have sort of like third-party agencies helping women try to figure out what the best options for them are. I can't say that it seems like that much has changed since the 80s in that respect.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Bonnie in Reedsburg is up. Hi, Bonnie.
Hello.
Hi. What would you like to say?
Well, in 1961, birth control came out, and I just think when people have no insurance, no money, probably no jobs, birth control should be their choice. And am I saying poor people can't have kids? I hope not. Definitely, that is not the Christian way. But I think we need more responsible people. And when I hear about stories about these poor people, like in the paper, there's always the single mothers and children. Where are the fathers? Like the other lady that was talking, she didn't have insurance. What about her husband? Usually, traditionally, a husband and wife both are working. So if one doesn't have it, the other one, you know, we always mm-hmm. have that choice. I could go one place or the other mm-hmm. for insurance.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing that, Bonnie. And Molly, I know that at least one of the stories that you outline in your story, it was a woman who did get married when she realized that she was pregnant, but neither of them had insurance through their employers.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that especially for people my age, you know, a number of people work jobs that don't provide such steady insurance, or maybe move around jobs more often. But certainly all the people that I spoke to for this piece were in committed relationships at the time when they got pregnant and tried to navigate these systems.
And it seems too, like more and more with the movement towards the gig economy, people are working for themselves, in effect, on contracts. So less and less options for insurance. Thanks for that call, Bonnie. Let's go to Liz in Waukesha next. Hi, Liz.
Hi. Hi there.
Hi. Go ahead.
My concern is and it was briefly mentioned, the attack against women having access to birth control. You can't have it both ways. Women that are young and maybe poor or working part-time for their $7 or $8 an hour can't afford insurance. It's often not offered. And now we got this Republican agenda to make birth control even more difficult for them. And yet they're tightening up the requirements for Medicaid, too. So what do they expect to see? What's the big picture? Where are all these children going to end up, and what kind of homes? Or it's just something that they haven't thought out, apparently.
Great. Thank you, Liz, for that comment. And I want to go back to something, Molly, that we mentioned in the intro to this interview, is that pregnancy and childbirth is the most expensive in the United States compared to other countries. Do we have a sense of why that is? What would need to change to make that not the case?
You know, I really, I have my own personal feelings about what we could do as a country to try to ensure that everyone has access to healthcare. But I don't know that if I'm really in a position to explain why the cost of giving birth has tripled since 1996. I think it's pretty complicated.
Lindsay Ann on Facebook wrote that she had two home births that cost less than $3,000 for each. She says that for the second pregnancy, she was backed up with Badger Care. She adds it's certainly not for every woman, but it was what worked best for her family. And I do remember in your article at least one woman who opted for kind of more natural birth and delivery because she was trying to avoid costs.
Yeah, but the funny thing with that is that she tried to do the same thing, I think, that a lot of women do. But then she ended up, I think, being in a hospital when they found out that she was about to go into labor. And she ended up there, I think, in a 30-hour labor or something like that. I mean, I think that a lot of women do try to do that. But unfortunately, you just sort of don't know which way it's going to go. And say, if your pregnancy has complications, they're going to want to be in a hospital. You don't know what kind of a cost you're going to incur doing that.
Right. Let's go back to the phones. And Hank is in Galena, Illinois. Hi, Hank.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to share?
So my wife and I, when we had our son, we had insurance. And even though we had insurance, when we first brought her in under my insurance, because we were just barely married when we found out we were pregnant and everything, they were like, well, you need to give us $7,000 at the doctor's office, like right now. Mm. And I told them no, that we were going to let them bill us and we were going to negotiate those bills. And they obviously didn't have a choice. They had to do it that way. And most people wouldn't even know that. But you can negotiate with the bills, and you can at least get 20% off every time somebody comes at your door with a bill. You can pay it during that first month. You can at least get 20% off of it. Oh, so a lot of times you can get a lot more.
Great. Well, thank you for that tip, Hank, and I'm glad that that worked for you and your wife. And Molly, I want to make sure before we run out of time that we mention that you touch on the experience of uninsured women of color in your article. How is their experience different from white women?
Oh, well, I mean, I think that the biggest thing that I've heard from women that I've spoken to is just like a real difficulty being heard by the doctors and healthcare providers that they speak to, whether they're insured or uninsured. A lot of the data suggests that even women of color who are insured and have great support systems end up in really dire situations. The maternal mortality rate is absolutely huge for that community. So it really suggests that insurance has very little to do with what's going on there.
And let's go back to the phones, and Nancy in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Nancy.
Good afternoon. I'm listening to this with great interest because I had my first child in 1951, obviously many, many decades ago. The total cost for maternity care, including the cost of the delivery, was $50. Hmm. The cost to take care of the baby in the nursery in the hospital was $4 a day. Now, my maternity care consisted of seeing the doctor once a month for 7 months, twice a month for the 8th month, and every week for the 9th month. And as it happened, I went almost a whole month overdue. So I got lots and lots of office visits, more than I really wanted to, because the doctor's office was on the 2nd floor and they had no elevator. And toward the end of a 10-month pregnancy, it got pretty tough climbing stairs. But my main reason for calling was the exorbitant cost that you're talking about today. I cannot conceive that this could even be happening.
Thanks for that call, Nancy. We're getting just a little short on time. And Molly, I'm sure if we had a handy dandy calculator for what $50 in 1951 was, it would not be anywhere near what people are paying for deliveries today.
Oh, yeah, absolutely not.
Yeah. So in just a couple minutes that we have left, when you wrote this article, another thing came to your attention and you wrote a follow up. Many families receive bills in the names of their infant children for basically things that happen once the baby is born. What did you find when you looked closer at that?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's actually a pretty common hospital policy, and one that is sort of billed separately through the insurance. But then you end up with all these bizarre little quirks in the system. Like I spoke to one person whose baby apparently chose an out-of-network provider for several $100 while his wife was sleeping. And so they got those bills separately, which comes as a huge shock to a lot of women, when down the line, even years later, one person that I spoke to had gotten some of these bills in their child's name.
Well, and it also seems that in a weird way, when we talk about like consumer protection and things like that, one of the areas that's kind of come out in the last few years is that you should really put a freeze on your child's credit record because, if people get a hold of your 2-year-old's social security number and take out loans and stuff, you might not know until that child is like 18. So if those bills actually go into collections, is that on the credit report of a 6-month-old baby?
Yeah, well, so technically one would imagine that that's not supposed to happen. Legally, those children aren't responsible for those bills since they're minors, right? And they would actually be on the parent's credit report. Although I certainly do not put it past collections agencies to have tried.
And as we wrap up, Molly, you said that, it's too big a question to kind of ask, what would need to change for pregnancy and childbirth not to be the most expensive in the U.S. compared to the rest of the world and, for insurance to be more understandable, things like that. But are there any kind of discrete things that you could see that the medical system could change that would make this a better experience for pregnant women, whether they have insurance or not? Because what you found out and what we heard from Hank and Galena is having insurance isn't a magic bullet.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly that one of the things for the Affordable Care Act marketplace would be to actually consider getting pregnant a significant life event and allow people to sign up for state-sponsored health care. I also think that... I think that's it.
Okay.
That's really my big thing, yeah.
And if you were going to give someone advice, if they just found out they were pregnant, they don't have insurance, what would be the best thing that they could do today?
I think that trying to educate yourself as much as possible about the options that are open to you, and probably calling one of the many wonderful nonprofit organizations that help people navigate this stuff would be my best thing.
Molly, thank you so much. Molly Osberg is a staff writer at Splinter News. I got to spend some time in the garden this weekend and noticed that my rhubarb is coming up. It's always one of the early arrivals. And then yesterday, an article caught my eye that made me think of those sour stalks in a whole new way. It turns out that when rhubarb is forced in darkness, like you force bulbs during the winter to get some nice spring blooms really early, it grows as much as an inch a day. They say that by avoiding photosynthesis, so keeping it in the dark, it makes the rhubarb less tart and also more tender. And not only that, it makes noise. If you don't believe me, take a listen. Experts say that as the stalks come up out of the buds, there is a popping sound. And then because they are planted closely together for maximum yield, as they get larger, the stalks rub together and create those squeaks and creaks that we just heard. I only have two plants and they're growing in the sun and they're well spaced out, but I still don't think I'll be turning my back on them after learning this. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about pain acceptance and opioids. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.